May the words that I speak and the meditations of all of our hearts find favor with you, O Lord. Amen. The word that seems to thread through all of today's lectionary lessons is persistence. Persistence, which is a kind of a repetitive continuing activity or undertaking in the face of any and all opposition or discouragement, to continue to do something. Persistence. We see it in the Old Testament lesson today, where Jacob wrestles with God all night. That's not just persistence, that's chutzpah. And in the second reading, where Paul is mentoring Timothy, and he says, be persistent in your teaching, in your preaching, and in delivering the message of Jesus Christ. Whether the times be favorable or unfavorable, persist. And we see it in the gospel lesson today. The parable that Jesus tells his disciples, and through his disciples tells all of us, about the persistent widow. Widow, a marginal member of society, almost invisible. Two strikes, a woman and a widow. And she persists in her case with the unjust justice. Persistence. It seems to be a highly rated value in both the Old and the New Testament. And it deserves a little bit of unpacking. What is persistence? It's really a two-step process. The first step is showing up, being a presence. And the second step is speaking up, being a nudge. I never really understood the importance of that first step, showing up, until I became a teacher at Greer Children's Community in the fall of 1970. I was one of 10 new teachers. Now, Greer Children's Community in Millbrook, New York, was a residential community for kids who were referred to as disadvantaged and pre-delinquent. I never understood where the pre came in, because these kids had pretty much been involved in delinquency, whether it was vandalism or truancy or theft, in some cases car theft, arson, but they were young. So there was a different system. So what social services did in its wisdom was to remove these kids from their homes. They were not orphans, but they had parents who either couldn't or wouldn't take care of them. So most of them were from New York City, not all, but most, and they were brought up to Millbrook. Rural community, almost 100% white. And these kids didn't fit in, and the schools in Millbrook really didn't want to see these kids. So the state created a public school district within this residential community to school these kids. So they had to hire teachers. So 10 of us showed up September of 1970. And we were told that these kids were challenging. That was an understatement. That's like saying a bomb makes a big noise. Challenging. Understatement. First day of classes, by lunchtime, five of the new teachers had left. One of them was heard to remark on his way to his car, "I would rather scrub toilets than try to teach those kids." By the next morning, four more had bailed, and I was the only one that showed up. Now, frankly, it was just German stubbornness. I prefer now to think of it as persistence in the theme of our day. But I was an experienced teacher. I could teach these kids. I could teach them. So here I would do these incredibly individualized lesson plans. And keep in mind, I had five students. Five, only five in my class. On the other hand, I only had two hands to hold on to them, because one of them would run out immediately. The other one would go under the table and sleep most of the day. And Carla, my only girl, would jump out the window and run around the campus. I had five kids, four boys, one girl. Two were black, two were white, one Hispanic. They were averaged between 10 and 12 years old. Here I had these great lesson plans. They would look at it for like a microsecond. They'd rip it up. "This bullshit. I ain't doing this. It's bullshit." Every day I'd come in and write my name on the board, Ms. Reichert. Nah, never once called me by my name. I was always either white woman or a honky, word that rhymes with witch. I was more often called the latter. I didn't know what to do, but I kept showing up, pure stubbornness. Now, in the midst of all this chaos, I noticed there was a moment of calm with my kids every day. And that moment of calm was when they went up to Mr. Kronk for their math lesson. Now, Mr. Kronk was a house parent at Greer, but they had to pull in some of the house parents because they couldn't keep the teachers. And Mr. Kronk was teaching math. And every afternoon when I took those kids to Mr. Kronk, they were as good as gold. Mr. Kronk's teaching style was pretty much this: "Sit down, shut up, your assignment's on the board, be quiet." You pick up a book. All my lesson plans, bullshit. But Mr. Kronk, they were good as gold. Leroy, who was always running away on me, would come roaring into class, "How you doing, Mr. Kronk?" Sit there and do his math. Turned out he's pretty very good in math. Carla would stop her running around the campus and come back. Even Antonio, who was asleep most of the day, would wake up for Mr. Kronk. So I said to Mr. Kronk, "What is your secret? What is it?" And Mr. Kronk said, "I've been here for 25 years. I'll be here tomorrow. And the day after tomorrow. And the kids know that. I show up." But oh man, how much time do I have to put in here? But I gradually began to see, as time went on, a little bit of a difference. I mentioned Leroy was good at math, so if I kind of casually dropped someplace a math lesson, Leroy couldn't help himself. He'd pick it up. Antonio even started to wake up for a little bit. Carla didn't run quite so much. And Chris, who looked like an angel, cherubic, blonde curly hair, blue eyes, gorgeous. He was about 3 foot tall. He's a car thief. He had stolen a car in Boston, and he drove it almost all the way to Albany before they pulled him over. 3 feet tall, he stole a lot of telephone directories, and he sat on some, and he put some on the accelerator. He said, "I didn't bother with the brake." But he was interested in things mechanical, probably because he crossed the wires on the car to get started. But when I would bring in a clock or a radio that was broken, or my father had a shaver that didn't work, and I just kind of leave it. I don't know if you know what the... He'd start working on it. And then came Christmas vacation, 2 weeks off. But the kids would talk among themselves. She ain't coming back. She gonna try to get another job. She can't get another job. She ain't no teacher. Mr. Kronk, he a teacher. Ooh, this was bruising. I mean, my ego took a battering. She ain't coming back. No. But I came back. And when they saw me the first day, I'll never forget this, Leroy comes running in. He's the head of the pack. And he comes around, he looks at me, he sees me, and he shouts over his shoulder, "Hey, Reichert's back!" First time they'd ever used my, not Miss Reichert. That would be going too far. Reichert's back. And things began to change. The importance of showing up. Now, I hasten to add, I was a good teacher. I took my teaching seriously. But I never forgot what got me to the point where I could teach was just showing up. First step. And that's what the widow does in the gospel lesson, the parable. She shows up, but she doesn't just show up. She speaks up. She's a nudge. She's an irritant. And think about that, as a woman, as a widow. And it's pretty clear that judge cared nothing for her. He cared nothing for her case, about which we know nothing, but he didn't care. Why did he grant her justice? Because he wanted to get rid of her. Now, it would be easy to kind of draw the conclusion that, you know, Jesus wants us to be persistent, to be an irritant, to be a nudge. But that's really not the crux of this parable. What Jesus wanted his disciples, and through his disciples, you and me, the message he wanted us to take away is this. If an unjust judge would grant justice to a widow for whom he cared nothing, how much more would a just and loving God respond to our prayers, the prayers of his beloved children? What are we being asked to do? Pray. We're being asked to pray. Persistence is just the path. Prayer is the destination, the goal. Pray. Ask. Ask. Ask for what? Ask for what you need. And Christ and God will respond to our need. They will respond. Now, very often, our prayers take the form of a Santa Claus wish list. Give me this, give me this, I want that. Or they are a list of our worries and our woes. Oh, I'm so worried about my health. I'm worried about my kids. I'm worried about the next mortgage payment. I'm worried I may lose my job. Christ, God, they know your worries. You don't have to list your worries and your woes. As Luther said, pray and let God worry. Because worry is the opposite of prayer. Worry is the opposite of prayer. Worry doesn't go anyplace. Prayer always goes someplace. May not go where you want it to go, may not go when you want it to go, but it's going to go someplace. It's going to go someplace. It's going to go to God. Ask God for what you need. Our vision is finite. We can only see so far. We can't see down the road, around the corner. But God's vision is infinite. And He knows where we fit into that infinite pattern. God knows what we need. So pray. Pray, dear Lord, you know me better than I know myself. Give me what I need. Give me the understanding to know what I need. But knowing that my vision is finite, give me the trust and faith in you that you will do for me what I need. And by the way, last point, don't forget to thank God. Now, frankly, God does not need our thanks. But we need to acknowledge our thanks to God for all of His blessings, for all that He has done for us. The bottom line here is, the power of persistent prayer. It works. Try it. Amen.